Chamber of Deputies of the National Palace in Mexico City. The ceremony was brief but colorful. On the flag-bedecked platform with Avila Camacho were his predecessor, Lázaro Cárdenas, whose presidential term expired at midnight, high Mexican officials, diplomatic representatives from other countries, and a large delegation of United States officials, led by Vice President-elect Henry A. Wallace and Ambassador Josephus Daniels. Tens of thousands of people milled in the streets outside, and another huge throng gathered in the plaza before the National Palace to wait the procession from the chamber. The crowds were orderly, and although many thousands of peons from neighboring states were armed as usual, there were no reports of shooting. Mexico City dispatches say that extreme caution was exercised, however, and the city was extremely well policed. In his inaugural speech, Avila Camacho pledged firm adhesion to the Monroe Doctrine within the principle of, as he put it, the equality of American nations. He declared that defense of the Americas is a common cause of all the countries, and that the continent, in his words, united in the common cause, will be invincible. Greater economic cooperation among the Americas, he said, will further strengthen hemispheric defense. For Mexico's part, he declared, this concept of mutual defense shortly will be implemented by a big naval building program. And to facilitate such a program, he said the Navy Department would be raised to a regular cabinet status. The CBS broadcast of the inaugural ceremony was interrupted. The American Telephone and Telegraph Company, New York, now explains that this interruption was due to a wire break in Monterrey caused by an electrical storm. But reports to CBS from Mexico say that sabotage of the telephone line may have taken place outside of Monterrey. In Europe, Romania's dictator, General Antonescu, declared today that Romania never will renounce her claims upon Hungary for the whole of Transylvania. Antonescu and a large gathering of armed guardsmen were gathered in the little mountain town of Alban Iulia to commemorate the 22nd anniversary of Romania's acquisition of Transylvania. The armed guardsmen pledged themselves to fight for the reunion.
The National Broadcasting Company presents Great Plays. Today, as the eighth production of its Great Plays series, the National Broadcasting Company presents an original script by Charles Newton on the revenge tragedies, sinister and macabre creations of a handful of brilliant poets and playwrights of the Elizabethan and Jacobean periods of the English drama.
Revenge tragedies, for the most part, are bitter and violent documents of satire against a society tainted with a growing corruption of wealth, justice, and morals. In this world of the early 17th century, when decadence was spreading everywhere, the dramatist showed that if a man would have justice, he must take it into his own hands. This world, they showed, was a chaos of black deeds, nemesis, and revenge. A world plunged in darkness and rent with wild passion.
Well, sir, then bring me forth, bring me through alley and alley, still with a distracted countenance going along. Let the clouds scowl, make the moon dark, the stars extinct, the winds blowing, the bells tolling, the owls shrieking, the toads croaking, the minutes jarring, and the clock striking 12. And then at last, sir, behold a man hanging and tottering, as you know the wind will wave a man, and I with a trice cut him down, and looking upon him by the advantage of my torch, find it to be my son, Horatio. There you may show a passion. There you may show a passion.
That was the cry of Geronimo of the Spanish tragedy, first of the great revenge plays. A cry that describes grotesquely the background that is typical to these horror stories of the early English drama. It is a cry of passion that preludes revenge. Only the final morbid gloating of the revenger over his bloody victim can exceed its ecstasy. Listen. We will let you hear such gloating as revengers love. This comes from John Webster's play, The White Devil.
Devil! rebel Bracciano, thou art damned.
Perpetually.
A slave condemned and given up to the gallows.
True, for thou art given up to the devil.
Oh, you slave, you that were held the famous politician whose art was poison.
And whose conscience murder.
Oh, Bracciano, thou art poisoned now thyself.
There's mercury.
And copper.
And quicksilver.
With other devilish apothecary stuff melting in your politic brains. Dust here.
This is Count Lodovico.
This Gasparo. And thou shalt die like a poor rogue.
And stink like a fly-blown dog.
And be forgotten before thy funeral sermon.
Such was the nightmare setting, the language and the passion of the revenge plays. These passages indicate the actions and the emotions which thrilled and terrified London audiences in the time of Elizabeth and James, and placed the revenge plays among the most popular drama of the age. And these are the grim titles that were stamped on handbills to intrigue the imagination of theatergoers. The Spanish Tragedy, Antonio's Revenge, The Malcontent, The Atheist's Tragedy, The Revenger's Tragedy, The Duchess of Malfi, The White Devil. These are the great revenge tragedies.
It was shortly before 1590 that the first of the revenge tragedies struck like a thunderbolt on the London stage. Thomas Kyd wrote it. It was called The Spanish Tragedy, and it made an instantaneous hit. Although Kyd's play was new to London, its general features were by no means new to the drama. Kyd borrowed most of them from the Roman poet Seneca, and merely capitalized on something secondhand by bringing it up to date. Other dramatists saw his play and were impressed with it, and three of them, John Marston, Cyril Turner, and John Webster, later wrote revenge plays of their own that were modeled on it to varying extents. In the brief 26 years that elapsed between 1590, the date of the Spanish tragedy, and 1616, the date of John Webster's Duchess of Malfi, the revenge tragedies of the English drama experienced their beginning, heyday, and decline. For with Webster and the Duchess of Malfi, the vigor of the tradition died.
In the days of Tudor England, society did not consider personal revenge the outrage against justice that we of the 20th century do. And so in the plays we speak of and act today, remember this. Revenge is not considered by our characters as a crime, but as a sacred duty that any honorable man must assume against the villain who has murdered his relative, mistress, or close friend. Remember this when you listen now to Thomas Kyd's Spanish Tragedy and hear the story of old Geronimo's revenge against the men who murdered his son. Somewhere, ensconced in the dim air, a ghost is hovering. And his sole companion is that ghastly spirit of heaven and hell they call revenge.
When this eternal substance of my soul did live imprisoned in my wanton flesh, I was a courtier in the Spanish court. My name was Don Andrea.
Then know, Andrea, that thou art arrived where thou shalt see the author of thy death. Don Balthazar, the Prince of Portugal, deprived of life. Here sit we down to see the mystery and serve for chorus in this tragedy.
Even as these two grim specters spoke of him, Don Balthazar, Prince of Portugal, was spending his days in sinful luxury at the Spanish court. There he fell in love with a lady called Belimperia, who had once been the dead Andrea's sweetheart. And when she rejected his suit and swore she would have him not, Don Balthazar sought out the lady's brother Lorenzo and begged his help.
My lord Balthazar, though Belimperia seemed thus coy, let reason hold you in your wonted joy. In time the savage bull sustains the yoke. In time all haggard hawks will stoop to lure. In time shall wedges cleave the hardest oak.
No, Lorenzo. She is wilder and more hard withal than beast or bird or tree or stony wall.
My lord, for my sake, leave this despair, and doubt not we will find some remedy. Some cause there is that lets you not be loved. First that must needs be known, and then removed. What if my sister loves some other knight?
My summer's day will turn to winter's night.
I have already found a stratagem to sound the bottom of this doubtful theme. My lord, you shall be ruled by me. Hinder me not. Oh, Pedregano!
Senor?
Bien que presto!
Hath your lordship any service to command me?
Aye, Pedregano, service of import. And not to spend the time in trifling words, thus stands the case. I will reward thee well, not with fair words, but store of golden coin. and lands and living join with dignities, if thou but satisfy my just command.
Whate'er it be your lordship shall command, my bounden duty bids me tell the truth.
Then, Pedringano, this is my demand. Who loves the lady you serve, my sister Belimperia?
Alas, my lord, since Don Andrea's death, I have no credit with her as before, and therefore know not if she love or no.
Nay, if thou tell her, then I am thy foe. Thy death shall bury what thy life conceals.
Oh, stay, my lord.
Yet speak the truth, and I will reward thee, and shield thee from whatever cause can ensue. But if thou tell her once, thou diest.
If Madame Belimperia be in love...
What villain ifs and ands?
Oh, stay, my lord. She loves Horatio.
What, Don Horatio... Knight Marshal, Hieronymo's son?
Even him, my lord.
Let this be all that thou shalt do for me. Be watchful when and where these lovers meet, and give me notice in some secret sort.
I will, my lord.
Then shalt thou find that I am liberal. Be therefore wise, and fail me not. Go and attend her as thy custom is, lest absence make her think thou dost amiss. Go, Pedrigano.
Farewell, my lord. I go.
How likes Prince Balthazar this stratagem? Where words prevail not, violence prevails. Let's go, my lord. Do you but follow me and gain your love. Belimperia's favor must be won by Horatio's remove.
And so, corrupted by gold, the servant Pedringano became all eyes and ears to intercept some news of Belimperia's next meeting with Horatio. And Belimperia, all unsuspecting, herself told him. This night, said she, Horatio and I will meet near his father's pleasant garden bower. Stand thou near the gate, and guard that entrance well, so that none may discover us there. But Pedringano bethought himself of the gold and rewards this information would bring if he told it to Lorenzo. So straightway, when night had fallen, he sought out Lorenzo and Prince Balthazar, gave hastily his news, and led them secretly to that pleasant garden bower, where Belimperia and Horatio sat, all unsuspecting.
My lord.
Who's there? Yes. Pedringano. We are betrayed.
Along away with her. Take her aside. Quickly dispatch him, my masters.
What? Will you murder me?
I, thus and thus. These are the fruits of love.
Oh, save his life and let me die for him. Oh, save him, brother. Save him, Balthazar. Murder! Murder! Help, Hieronymo, help!
Come, stop her mouth.
Ah!
Away with her.
Christ, pluck me from my naked bed. Who calls Hieronymo? Speak!
Oh. Stay. What murderous spectacle is this? Man hanged up and all the murder is gone. Did my bar to lay the guilt on me? This place was made for pleasure, not for death. These garments that he wears I oft have seen.
Alas, it is Horatio, my sweet son. Oh! Was it thou that caused me from my bed? Who hath slain my son? Oh, heavens! Why made you knight to cover sin? Fair worthy son, not conquered, but betrayed. Seest thou this handkerchief besmeared with thy blood? It shall not from me till I take revenge. Seest thou those wounds that yet are bleeding fresh? I'll not entomb them till I have revenge.
Revenge. Broughtst thou me hither to increase my pain? I looked that Balthazar should have been slain. But it's Horatio, my friend, that is slain.
Thou talkst of harvest when the corn is green. The sickle comes not till the corn is ripe. Be still a while, Andrea.
What's here? A letter. Letter written to me, Hieronymo. For want of ink, receive this bloody writ. Me have my hapless brother hid from me. Revenge thyself on
Balthazar
and him, for these were they that murdered thy son, Belimperia. My son slain by Lorenzo and the prince. Then will I have revenge upon them. But how? All times fit not for revenge. Thus therefore will I rest me in unrest, dissembling quiet in unquietness, not seeming that I know their villainies, that my simplicity may make them think that ignorantly I will let all slip. Yes, Hieronymo, thou must enjoin thine eyes to observation, and thy tongue to milder speeches than thy spirit affords, thy heart to patience, and thy hands to rest, thy cap to courtesy, and thy knee to bow, till revenge thou know when,
where, and how.
But somehow the news of Horatio's murder spread through the court and grew secretly, as such rumors do. And although no one knew for sure who the murderers were, none could help but notice that Hieronymo behaved strangely towards the Duke of Castile's son, Lorenzo. The Duke himself got wind of this, and it worried him. So one day the Duke called Hieronymo to him.
Welcome, Hieronymo.
My Lord Duke, and you, my lords, Prince Balthazar and Lorenzo, I thank you for Horatio.
Hieronymo, the reason that I sent to speak with you is this.
What's so short, your grace? And I'll be gone, I thank you for it.
Nay, stay, Hieronymo. Go call him, Lorenzo.
Hieronymo, my father craves a word with you.
With me, sir? Why, my Lord Duke, I thought you had done.
No. Would he had.
Hieronymo, I hear you find yourself aggrieved at my son.
Why, is not this a miserable thing, my lord?
Hieronymo, I hope you have no cause. And I would be loath that one of your deserts should even once have reason to suspect my son, considering how I think of you myself.
Your son, Lorenzo? Whom, my noble lord? The hope of Spain? Mine honorable friend?
Hieronymo, I never gave you cause.
My good lord, Lorenzo, I know you did not.
There, then. Pause. And for the satisfaction of the world, Hieronymo, here before Prince Balthazar and me, embrace each other. And be perfect friends.
I marry, my lord, and shall. Friends, quoth he. See, I'll be friends with you all, especially with you, my lovely Lord Balthazar.
Why, this is friendly done, Hieronymo.
And that I hope. Old grudges are forgot.
What else, Lorenzo? It were a shame it should not be so.
Awake!
Awake for why?
Awake, revenge, for thou art ill-advised to sleep. Awake!
Content thyself and do not trouble me.
Awake, revenge! Hieronymo with Lorenzo is joined in league and intercepts our passage for revenge. Awake, revenge, or we are all begone.
Content thyself, Andrea. Though I sleep, yet is my mood soliciting their souls. Suffice it thee that poor Hieronymo cannot forget his son, Horatio. Nor dies revenge, although he sleep a while.
Another two, beside the ghost of Andrea, despaired at Hieronymo's apparent friendship with his son's murderers. That was Belimperia, to whom Lorenzo had given back freedom on condition she tell no one of the villainy she had seen. But even though Belimperia kept her silence, she could not forget. And she bitterly reproached Hieronymo because he did not take revenge.
Is this the love thou bearest, Horatio? Oh, unkind father. Oh, deceitful world. For here I swear, in sight of heaven and earth, shouldst thou neglect the love thou shouldst retain and give it over and devise revenge no more, myself shall send their hateful souls to hell.
And here I vow, so you but give us consent and will conceal my resolution, I will ere long determine of their deaths that causeless have murdered my son.
Hieronymo, I will consent, conceal, and aught that may affect for thine avail, join with thee to revenge Horatio's death.
On then, and whatsoever I devise, let me entreat you, help me to carry out. For why the plot's already in mine head,
The plot is laid of dire revenge, and nothing wants but acting of revenge.
Yes, the plot was already laid. First, Geronimo went to Don Lorenzo and Prince Baltazar and told them the King of Spain had requested that he, Geronimo, arrange some entertainment to be presented before the court. He then begged that Lorenzo and Baltazar help him by themselves taking part in this entertainment, which was to be a play. He and Belimperia, he said, would act in it too. So Lorenzo and Don Baltazar said, yes, we will help you act this play. It may prove some sport. But mark this. The parts Geronimo gave them were those of two men whose stage murder was called for by the plot of that play. But Lorenzo and Baltazar suspected nothing. Geronimo's feigned friendship had convinced them he was harmless. And so one night the King of Spain and his whole court assembled to witness this play, the play Geronimo and his friends would act in. They applauded the scenes and gasped with admiration at the realistic way in which Geronimo stabbed Lorenzo and Belimperia killed Prince Baltazar. Bravo, they shouted and clapped. Until suddenly the play stopped and Geronimo disappeared from the stage and in a moment returned from behind the curtain, dragging behind him a dead stabbed body, which he held up to the view of all. The king and all the courtiers and fine ladies started back in horror because they recognized that body as the corpse of Don Horatio, Geronimo's son.
See here, my show. Look on this spectacle. Here lay my hope, and here my hope had end. Here lay my heart, and here my heart was slain. The cause was love, whence grew the mortal hate that brought about Horatio's death. The love my son to Belimperia, the hate Lorenzo and young Balthazar. Merciless, they butchered up my boy in black dark night to pale dim cruel death. And likewise here before your very eyes, so have we too killed Lorenzo and Prince Baltazar and paid revenge? Revenge is due.
Oh, hearken all. Hold, Geronimo. My son and his friend are slain.
Have ended their effects when blood and sorrow finish my desires. Aye, these were spectacles to please my soul.
And now this hand of mine shall hail those villains down to deepest hell, where none but furies, bugs, and tortures dwell.
Then, sweet revenge, do this at my request. Let me be judge, and doom them to unrest.
Then haste me down to meet thy friends and foes, to place thy friends in ease, the rest in woes. For here, though death hath ended their misery, I'll there begin their endless tragedy.
Thus ends the story of Thomas Kidd's Spanish tragedy, with a ghost and revenge, their hatred still unslaked, vowing to pursue revenge against the villains, even into the world beyond death.
In 1602, more than 10 years after it was first performed, Thomas Kidd's Spanish tragedy was still enjoying revival performances. The renowned Ben Jonson himself wrote certain additions into the text at that time, and John Marston, seeking to capitalize on its perennial popularity, wrote a new revenge play, which he called Antonio's Revenge. In Antonio's Revenge, you will find parallel after parallel on the Spanish tragedy. Here again, the play's hero undertakes revenge against the murderers of a relative. There is a ghost, this time projected into the thick of the action, who cries out for revenge and urges the hero onto it. There is a villain and a tool villain, like Lorenzo and Pendrigano of the Spanish tragedy. And the hero fulfills his plot of revenge in this play, too, in an ingenious manner. Not by means of a play within the play, as Geronimo did, but by staging a mask, a kind of pageant in music and pantomime, which had grown very popular by Marston's day. And in Antonio's Revenge, too, terrible scenes of murder and revenge were set against a background of blackest night, lit only by flickering torchlight. There are scenes in the gloomy vaults of St. Mark's in Venice. Characters appear intermittently upon the stage in night undress and with torches. And ghosts walk abroad and cry out for revenge.
Aye, there was a play that was sweet music to my ears.
Who said that?
Mary, sir. I said it.
Well, who are you? And where are you? I can't see you.
I am here. But your eye is some 400 years out of practice. So you can't see me. Sir, I am a ghost.
I thought there was something familiar about your voice. Are you Don Andrea's ghost in the Spanish tragedy we just played?
Sir, I am that ghost. And I am also the ghost of any other murdered man you will hear in these tragedies. I am the symbol of all ghosts who cry out restlessly for revenge.
Thank you, sir, for your appearance here today.
It gives me pleasure. But proceed. I would hear your actors play Antonio's Revenge. The horrifying lines I spoke in that tragedy ravish my soul with pleasure. Play on.
I'm afraid we hadn't planned to act out the story of Antonio's Revenge. We have only an hour's time for this program, you know, and we have a good deal more to tell.
Not play Antonio's Revenge? 'Tis my choicest role. Play it, I say.
I'm afraid it's impossible.
Rash fool to deny me! Play it, I say, before I lash thee with scorpions into blackest hell!
You're upsetting our program. I may not be able to see you, but if you don't keep quiet, I'll have them turn on the studio fans and blow you out of here.
Alas, I see that no longer have I the power to affright men that I held in the days of Queen Bess. Kind sir.
Well?
Before you proceed, may I not speak just a few lines of mine from Antonio's Revenge? 'Twill serve to show you how thoroughly the playwright Marston understood me, and how well he could use me to fright the audiences of his day, even till the hair rose upright on their heads.
All right, then, but hurry.
I spoke these lines as the ghost of old Andrugio, urging my son to revenge me. Marston had me rise from the tomb itself to speak thus to him.
No prologue, please. Our time is limited.
Thus I spoke to my son, Antonio. Thy pangs of anguish ripped my seer-cloth up. And lo, the ghost of old Andrugio forsakes his coffin. Antonio, revenge. I was empoisoned by Piero's hand. Revenge my blood. Take spirit, gentle boy. Revenge my blood. Seize on revenge. Grasp the stern bended front of frowning vengeance with unpaced clutch. Alarum, Nemesis. Rouse up thy blood. Invent some stratagem of vengeance which but to think on may like lightning glide with horror through thy breast.
Oh.
Were not those noble words, sir?
I had some nice lines in Antonio's Revenge myself.
And who are you? Have you come from a costume ball?
Sir, you do insult me. The best tailors in London have turned my doublet. The best clothers sewn my hose. I, sirrah, am a Machiavelli.
The Machiavelli?
Nay, sir. But all politic villains of my age were named after that great philosophizing scoundrel. In short, sir, I am a villain. In the Spanish tragedy, they called me Lorenzo. In Antonio's Revenge, I was Piero, and so on. I am the conventional villain of all revenge tragedies.
Although in these modern times we may have no ghosts, I can assure you, sir, we still have plenty of villains.
And oh, what a pleasing arrant knave did Marston make me. I was that man, sir, who murdered old Andrugio, whose ghost you just heard speak.
You were?
Listen, sirrah. I opened the play with these lines. 'Tis yet dead night. No spirit moves upon the breast of earth, save howling dogs, night crows, and screeching owls. save meager ghosts, myself, and black thoughts. Lord, in 2 hours, what a topless mount of unpeered mischief have these hands cast up. I am great in blood, unequaled in revenge. You horrid scouts, that sentinel swart knight, give loud applause from your large palms. Poison the father, butcher the son, and marry the mother.
A villain like you should be in prison.
In prison? Nay, that would have been too good for Piero. I took better revenge by killing him.
Good heavens, now who are you?
I also am a character you will find in every revenge tragedy. I was Geronimo in the Spanish tragedy, Antonio in Antonio's Revenge. I, sir, am the revenger.
And it was you that killed the villain who just spoke?
Aye, that I did. Listen to what I swore. May I be cursed by my father's ghost and blasted with incensed breath of heaven if my heart beat on aught but vengeance. May I be numbed with horror and my veins pucker with singeing torture if my brain digest a thought but of dire revenge. May I be fettered slave to coward chance if blood, heart, brain plot aught save vengeance.
All I can say is that never in my life have I met up with so bloodthirsty a group of scoundrels as you three. Now silence, all of you. We've got a script that must be followed here.
In 1604, 2 years after the completion of Antonio's Revenge, Marston wrote a second play that followed closely in the revenge tragedy pattern. But in this play, Marston introduced a new element to the plot, one that Kidd had not used. This was a type of humor character, whom the audiences of the day called a malcontent. And Marston named his new play The Malcontent after this stock character. Now, a malcontent was a man who'd been either wrongfully deprived of his inheritance or had been cheated out of some reward due him for service rendered to others. Therefore, this man invariably became embittered against the world and developed into its outspoken critic. It was through the mouth of this creature that Marston poured his satire, his invective, against decadent society. And both Turner and Webster, greater dramatists than Marston, later adopted his malcontent character into their own revenge tragedies for exactly the same purpose. Vendice, the hero of Cyril Turner's revenge tragedy, written about 1607, was a malcontent. And the eloquence of his satire must have made people of his day pause and think.
Think upon the pleasure of the palace, secure at ease and state. The stirring meats ready to move out of the dishes that e'en now quicken when they're eaten. Banquets abroad by torchlight, music, sports, bare-headed vassals that had ne'er the fortune to keep on their own hats, but let horns wear 'em. 9 coaches waiting, hurry, hurry, hurry.
Aye, to the devil.
Oh, impudence. Thou goddess of the palace, mistress of mistresses to whom the costly perfumed people pray, strike thou my head into dauntless marble, mine eyes to steady sapphires.
Thus spoke Vendice of the Revenge's tragedy. This man had once lived happily as a member of the court, and he had a sweetheart beyond compare. A duke, degenerate head of a degenerate family, had coveted this girl for himself. But she, true to her love of Vendice, would have none of him. It was in the wild anger of frustration, then, that the Duke's lust for her changed to hatred. It was in the unbridled passion of hate that he arbitrarily had her poisoned. And so her love of Vendice swore a great vow of revenge. And to keep it ever present in his mind, Vendice carried with him constantly the skull of his dead sweetheart. This was his ghost. This was the tangible horror that haunted his mind and senses every hour that revenge went unfulfilled. He was brooding over this skull one day when his brother Hippolyto approached.
Still sighing over death's visit.
Brother, welcome. What comfort bringest thou? How go things at court?
In silk and silver, brother. Never braver.
Pooh, thou placed upon my meaning. Prithee, say, has that bald Madam Opportunity yet thought upon? Speak. Are we happy yet?
Thy wrongs and mine are for one scabbard fit.
It may prove happiness.
What is it may prove? Give me to taste.
Give me your hearing, then. Last evening, predecessor unto this, the Duke's son warily inquired for me, and the whole aim and scope of his intent ended in this, conjuring me in private to seek some strange digested fellow forth of ill-contented nature, either disgraced in former times or by new grooms displaced, such a blood, a man that were for evil only good, to give you the true word, some base-coined pander.
I'll put on that villainous role for once and be a right man then, a man of the time. For to be honest is not to be of the world. Brother, I'll be that strange, composed fellow. It will keep me in the court and mayhap advance some opportunity for my revenge.
Then I'll prefer you, brother.
Go to, then. The smallest advantage fattens wronged men. And as I say, it may point out occasion.
So next day, Van Dyce found himself some fit disguise and entered into the service of the Duke's son. He spake all fair and executed his villainous job of pander so well that soon the news of his competence came to the ears of the Duke himself, the man who had poisoned Van Dyce's sweetheart, the man he had vowed to take revenge on. Van Dyce came immediately with this news to his brother Hippolyto.
Oh, sweet! Delectable, rare, happy, ravishing.
Why, what's the matter, brother?
Oh, 'tis able to make a man spring up and knock his forehead against yon silver ceiling.
Prithee, tell me, why may not I partake with you? You vowed once to give me share to every tragic thought.
By the mass, I think I did too. Then I'll divide it to thee. The old Duke, thinking my outward shape and inward heart are cut of one piece, that precious Duke himself, mind you, the Duke, hires me by price to greet him with a lady in some fit place, veiled from the eyes of the court, to which I easily, but to follow out my purpose of revenge, consented, and did wish his impudent grace to meet her here in this unsunned lodge, where 'tis night at noon. The hour approaches, brother.
Aye, but where's that lady now?
Oh, at that word, I'm in a throng of happy apprehensions. He's suited for a lady. I have took care for a delicious lip, a sparkling eye. You shall be witness, brother. Be ready. Stand with your hat off. I'll fetch her to you.
Troth, I wonder what lady it should be.
What lady it should be. Troth, a strange lady. One designated to carry out Ben Dyce's work of revenge in such a fashion that would make Nemesis applaud. For this is what Ben Dyce had done. He had taken one of those dummies the tailors use for clothes, and he had dressed it in finery. And for the head on this material lady, Van Dyce had affixed the precious skull of his mistress. First he had rubbed it well with deadly poison, then nailed it securely in place, and finally attired it into the concealing hat and veil which ladies wore in those days when they went alone to keep an assignation. And by means of a small handle on her back, Van Dyce carried this dreadful lady along so skillfully that Hippolyto suspected nothing when he saw her coming toward him.
Grace will not be absent long. Secret? Ne'er doubt us, madam. It will be worth 3 velvet gowns to your ladyship. Hold. I'll save your hand at labor. I'll unmask you.
Why, brother! Brother!
Art thou beguiled now? Tut! A lady can, as such all disguised, fool a wiser man. Have I not fitted the old Duke with a quaint piece of beauty? Here's an eye able to tempt a great man to serve God, a pretty hanging lip that has forgot now how to dissemble. Methinks this mouth should make a swearer tremble, a drunkard clasp his teeth and not undo em, to suffer wet damnation to run through em. Here's a cheek keeps her color. Let the wind go whistle, spout rain, we fear thee not. Be hot or cold, all's one with us.
Brother, you spoke that right. Is this the very form that living shone so bright?
The very same. And now methinks I could e'en chide myself for doting on her beauty, though her death shall be revenged after no common action. Does the silkworm expend her yellow labors for thee? For thee does she undo herself?
A lordship sold to maintain ladyships for the poor benefit of a bewildering minute. Surely we're all mad people.
Aye, brother, true.
Does every proud and self-affecting dame campfire her face for this and grieve her maker in sinful baths of milk when many an infant starves for her superfluous outside? All for this. Who now bids £20 a night, prepares music, perfumes, and sweetmeats? All are hushed. Thou mayst lie chaste now.
Why resort you to this grisly stratagem, brother?
This very skull whose mistress the Duke poisoned shall be revenged in the like strain and kiss his lips to death. I have rubbed strong, deadly poison on this lady's lips.
Brother, I do applaud thy constant vengeance, the quickness of thy malice above thought.
Ah, brother, the Duke comes. Pull you back a little with the bow, Neely.
I will.
So. Now 9 years' vengeance crowd into a minute.
Well done, fellow. I see thou hast brought her. What lady is't?
Faith, my lord, a country lady. A little bashful at first, as most of them are, but after the first kiss, my lord, the worst is past with them. Your grace knows now what you have to do. She has somewhat a grave look with her.
I love that best. Conduct her here.
So, sir.
In gravest looks, the greatest faults seem less. Give me that sin that's robed in holiness.
Keep back with that torch. Brother, raise her veil.
I must be bold with you, my lass. A kiss.
Oh! Oh, what's this? A skull! Oh!
Royal villain! White devil!
No!
Brother, place the torch here, that his affrighted eyeballs may start into the hollows of his skull. Duke, dost know yon dreadful visage?
No.
Do it well. 'Tis the skull of Gloriana, whom thou poisonst last.
Oh, it has poisoned me.
Didst not know that till now.
Where are you two?
Villains, all three. The very ragged bone has been sufficiently revenged.
Oh, Hippolyto, go! Treason!
Yes, my lord. Treason, treason, treason.
Bravo, bravo. Wasn't that a quaint stratagem, sirs? Of all the parts I've played, I like that best.
Of all the parts you've played? Certainly that wasn't your voice I heard as Vendice's.
Yes, I've told you already, sir. I am the symbol of the revenger in all revenge tragedies. I am the spirit which prompts such men to speech and action. Was not a good play?
It was deplorable.
Oh, the ghost again. So you didn't enjoy Cyril Turner's revenger's tragedy?
Cyril Turner, indeed. Was not a scurvy trick of his to use a skull instead of a ghost in that play?
Perhaps so. But you must remember, sir, that by 1607, when Turner wrote his play, you ghosts couldn't frighten audiences as you did in Thomas Kidd's day. In fact, I've heard it on good authority that some audiences laughed at you.
True, true. The world was growing skeptical already.
However, I'm afraid we must get on. The last great dramatist of the revenge tragedy cycle of plays was John Webster, who ranks among the very greatest of the Elizabethan and Jacobean poets. Webster wrote two revenge tragedies, The White Devil in 1612 and The Duchess of Malfi in 1616. In them, the vigor of the revenge tragedy tradition wanes, for Webster ushers in, with borrowed blood and thunder, the decline of the drama in early 17th century England.
Decline indeed. That rank scoundrel used a poor substitute indeed for ghosts. Listen what he had Francesco de' Medici do in The White Devil.
To fashion my revenge more seriously, let me remember my dead sister's face. Call for her picture? No. I'll close mine eyes, and in a melancholic thought, I'll frame her figure for me. Now I have't. How strong imagination works. How she can frame things which are not.
Things which are not. Why, such talk denies our existence, even.
Aye, but how magnificently that Webster painted me and mine.
You, sir, are the...
I, Sirrah, am the Machiavel villain. There were not one, but two of us in the Duchess Amalfi. Ferdinand and the Cardinal.
Mark, Prince Ferdinand. A very salamander lives inside to mock the eager violence of fire.
That Cardinal has made more bad faces with his oppression than ever Michelangelo made good ones. He lifts up his nose like a foul porpoise before a storm.
The Lord Ferdinand laughs.
Like a deadly cannon that lightens ere it smokes.
In such a deformed silence, witches whisper their charms.
Yes, I can see that Webster knew you Machiavell villains well. But why should that please you so? After all, he brought about the destruction of Ferdinand and the Cardinal.
By me!
Nay, by me!
Revenger and malcontent disputing for the honor, I see. Well, in a way, you're both right. For the man who killed Ferdinand and the Cardinal were both revenger and malcontent in one. Like Ben Dice in the Revenger's tragedy. But he was a villain to boot, if you remember. That was Vasola.
Vasola, the only court Gaul. Yet I observe his railing is not for simple love of piety. Indeed, he rails at those things which he wants. Would be as lecherous, covetous, or proud, bloody, or envious as any man, if he had means to be so.
Exactly, means to be so. Vasola lacked means, and because of that, it was an easy task to corrupt him into villainy. This is his story, as told in The Duchess of Malfi.
I do haunt you still, great Cardinal.
So, Vasola?
I have done you better service than to be slighted thus.
You enforce your merit too much.
I fell into the galleys in your service, and now to be slighted thus.
I would that you could become honest.
With all your divinity, do but direct me the way to it. I have known many travel far for it, and yet return as errant knaves as they went forth, because they carried themselves along with them. Nay, will you go even while I talk? Some fellows, they say, are possessed with a devil. But that Cardinal were able to possess the greatest devil and make him worse.
So Vasola next went to the Cardinal's brother, Prince Ferdinand. He had small hope of gaining favor from that villain either, but he had little else to do but try. Therefore, he was astonished when Prince Ferdinand greeted him by saying,
"There's gold, Vasola."
So, what follows? Never rained such showers as these without thunderbolts in the tail of them. Whose throat must I cut?
Your inclination to shed blood rites post before my occasion to use you. I give you that to live at the court here and observe my sister, the Duchess, to note all the particulars of her behavior, what suitors do solicit of her marriage, and whom she best affects. She's a young widow. I would not have her marry again.
No, sir.
Do not ask the reason, but be satisfied. I say I would not.
It seems you would create me one of your familiars.
Familiars? What's that?
Why, a very quaint, invisible devil in flesh. An intelligencer.
Such a kind of thriving thing I would wish thee. And ere long thou mayest arrive at a higher play by it.
So once again, in hope of gold and rewards, Vasola entered into service for Ferdinand, and as he later found, for the Cardinal. For that august villain was in close league with his brother. Vasola applied himself diligently to spying on the Duchess of Malfi, and before many months had passed, he discovered that beautiful young woman, whom all thought to be a widow, had been secretly married to one of her courtiers, and had borne him a son. This news Vasola hastened to write down and send by letter to Ferdinand and to the Cardinal. They received it 3 days later at the Cardinal's palace in Rome.
I have this night digged up a mandrake.
What say you, Ferdinand?
I'm grown mad with it.
What's the prodigy?
Read there. A sister damned. She's loose at the hilts. Grown a notorious strumpet.
Speak lower.
Lower? Rogues do not whisper now, but seek to publish aloud. Oh, confusion seize her.
Why do you make yourself so wild a tempest?
Shall our blood, the royal blood of Aragon and Castile, be thus attainted?
Yeah, you fly beyond your reason. And how idly shows this rage and this intemperate noise.
Have you not my palsy?
Yes, but I can be angry without this abandon. Come, put yourself in tune.
So I will only study to seem the thing I am not. I could kill her now, in you or in myself, but I do think it is some sin in us. Heaven doth revenge by her.
Are you stark mad?
Than to marry and bear children to Antonio. A slave that only smelled of ink and counters, and never in his life looked like a gentleman but in the audit time. Only her blood shall quench my wildfire.
I'll leave you.
There I have done. I'm confident had I been damned in hell and should have heard of this, it would have put me into a cold sweat.
But in spite of the cardinal's reserve, he joined immediately with Ferdinand in plotting revenge on their young sister, the Duchess, for her actions. The Duchess tried to escape, but Bazzola, at the head of a troop of guards, seized her before she could get away. Bazzola then brought her back by order of the Prince Ferdinand to her own palace, and there imprisoned her. Although Ferdinand and the cardinal were intent on the Duchess's death, for that alone could satisfy their thirst for revenge upon her, they first sought to break down her spirit by imposing every indignity upon her that their devilish minds could devise.
How doth our sister Duchess spare herself in her imprisonment, Bazzola?
Nobly, Prince Ferdinand. I'll describe her. She's sad as one long used to it, and she seems rather to welcome the end of misery than shun it. A behavior so noble as gives a majesty to adversity. You may discern the shape of loveliness more perfect in her tears than in her smile.
Her melancholy seems to be fortified with a strange disdain. Curse upon her! I will no longer study in the book of another's heart. Inform her what I told you.
Then Bazzola went to the Duchess's chambers to bring her news that she must die. To terrify her the more, he went disguised as the grisly tomb maker that would build her coffin. Two executioners waited, concealed behind the arras, to do the bloody deed that he heralded.
I am come to make thy tomb.
My tomb? Thou speakest as if I lay upon my deathbed, gasping for breath. Dost thou perceive me sick?
Yes. And the more dangerously, since thy sickness is insensible.
Thou art not mad, sure. Dost know me?
Yes.
Am I not thy duchess?
Thou art some great woman, sure, for riot begins to sit on thy forehead clad in gray hairs 20 years sooner than on a merry milkmaid's. Thou sleepest worse than if a mouse should be forced to take up her lodging in a cat's ear. A little infant that breathes its teeth, should it lie with thee, would cry out, as if thou wert the more unquiet bedfellow.
I am Duchess of Malfi. Still.
That makes thy sleep so broken.
Nay, then. I see now thou hast come upon some mortal errand from my brother. Have done. You bring me death, I think. What death?
Strangling.
Oh.
Oh, there. Here are your executioners.
I forgive them. The apoplexy, catarrh, or cough of the lungs would do as much as they do.
Doth not death frighten you?
Who would be afraid, aunt, knowing to meet such excellent company in the other world?
Yet, methinks, the manner of your death should much afflict you. This cord should terrify you.
Not a whit. What would it pleasure me to have my throat cut with diamonds, or to be smothered with cassia, or to be shot to death with pearls? I know death hath 10,000 several doors for men to make their exits. And 'tis found they go on such strange geometrical hinges, you may open them both ways. Anyway, for heaven's sake, so I'm out of your whispering. Tell my brothers that I perceive death now I am well awake. Best gift is they can give, or I can take. But I would pain put off my last woman's fault. I'll not be tedious to you.
We are ready.
Dispose my breath, how please you. Pull, and pull strongly, for your able strength must pull down heaven upon me. Yet stay. Heaven gates were not so highly arched as princes' palaces. They that enter there must go upon their knees. So I must kneel. Come, violent death. Serve the Mandragora to make me sleep.
Is she dead, Bazola?
She is what you'd have her, Prince Ferdinand. But here begin your pity. Fix your eye here upon her body.
Constantly.
Do you not weep? Other sins only speak. Murder shrieks out.
Cover her face. Mine eyes dazzle. She died young.
I think not so. Her infelicity seemed to have years too many.
Let me see her face again. Why didst thou not pity her? What an excellent, honest man mightst thou have been if thou hadst borne her to some sanctuary. For playing a villain's part, I hate thee for it. And for my sake, say thou hast done much ill will.
Let me quicken your memory, for I perceive you are falling into ingratitude. I challenge the reward due to my service.
I'll tell thee what I'll give thee.
Do.
I'll give thee a pardon for this murder.
It was then that Bazola, half wild with rage and despair, and haunted now by conscience and remorse for the crimes he had committed, it was then that Bazola turned against his powerful masters, Prince Ferdinand and the Cardinal, and murdered them in cold blood. But Bazola received his own death blow in the sword fight which marked that affair. And as he lay dying in agony, he summed his life in a final torrent of bitter, gasping words.
Oh, I am gone. In a mist. Fare you well. It may be pain, but no harm to me to die in so good a quarrel. Oh, this gloomy world. In what a shadow or deep pit of darkness doth womanish and fearful mankind live. Let worthy minds ne'er stagger in distrust to suffer death or shame. For what is just, mine is another voyage.
As you can see, the revenge play cycle, as it was concluded in Webster's Duchess of Malfi, had come a long way from Kidd's early Spanish tragedy. First, in the Duchess, revenge was no longer pictured as a sacred duty undertaken by a good man against the murderer of his friend or mistress. The revenge by Bazola was that of one villain against another, brought about by complex psychological developments. Second, there was no ghost in this play.
Eh? No ghost. The ghost is in oblivion.
There was no strong, upright hero. Antonio was a weakling whose voice throughout the play one could hardly hear. There was no heroine here like Belle and Peria. The Duchess of Malfi was little more than a symbol of passive goodness plowed under in a world of violence and crime. And the dominating figures of Webster's play are the desperate malcontent and the Machiavelli villain, cruel masters of a degenerate world. Webster did not write The Duchess of Malfi as Kidd had composed The Spanish Tragedy merely to create a vivid, exciting tale. No. Webster simply adopted a form that was there to hand, one that Kidd had started, Marston and Turner developed, to write a play with a social message, a message to a society which had grown rich and corrupt with the fruits of other men's striving, a message that condemned the luxury and debauchery of the palace, a message that condemned the perversion of a social justice which bestowed wealth and more wealth on the powerful and made the poor more poverty-stricken and wretched than before. Only the blood and thunder of the revenge tragedy convention remained in Webster's last great play. The original character of the revenge tragedy had disappeared and was never to reappear in the English drama. Only the blood and thunder remained, and a damning indictment of the contemporary world that sounded like a dirge for Tudor England.
During the past hour, you have heard an original treatment of the revenge tragedies of the 17th century, written by Charles Newton, with Morris Karnofsky as the revenger. Others in today's cast were Olive Deering, Kay Strozzi,
John Brewster, Joseph Curtin, Charles Webster, Stefan Schnabel, Gerald Andre, Peter Capel, William Shelley, Sidney Smith, Ian Martin, Ralph Kellard, and Joseph DeSantis. The original musical score was written by Gail Kubik. The orchestra was directed by Joseph Honte. A Great Plays drama guide by Blevins Davis, who arranged for the series, is available to our radio audience through Columbia University Press at the cost of 25 cents. Send coin or money orders to Great Plays, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. The Great Plays drama guide contains a summary of the plot, sketch of the author's life, and pertinent facts about each of the 30 plays in this series. Consult your local library for reading material on the remaining great plays of the series. Next Sunday at this hour, we'll present The Speed by Pierre Corneille. Has been presented as a public service by the National Broadcasting Company and the independent radio stations associated with the NBC networks, and came to you from the RCA building, Radio City, New York.